All right, I think we're ready to start. I'd like to thank everyone for attending the 2020 Digital Sunstone Symposium Session 221, titled The Sexual What If Syndrome, Grieving Our Sexual Development. The audio from this session will be available for purchase at sunstone.org after the symposium. The video recording of this session will be available in the Whova app for the remainder of 2020. We will have a Q&A at the end, so you go ahead and type your questions into the Whova app. We've already got a few in there. That's great, and we will get to those. At Sunstone, we are making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our tagline is, there is more than one way to Mormon. We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. Please support us in our mission by making a donation and subscribing at sunstone.org. About this presentation, many people who transition from Orthodox Mormonism to either post or nuanced positions often revisit their sexual development journey as a youth and young adult. They often feel like many decisions were co-opted by the standards of the church and are dealing with grief, anger, feelings of betrayal, and the what-if syndrome. These what-ifs can be a normal part of the grief cycle, and yet can also interfere with moving forward in sexually healthy ways. The session will address some common what-ifs that people deal with, as well as some strategies to move into healthier paradigms. I'll take a second to introduce to you our speakers before we begin. Natasha Helfer Parker is the owner of Symmetry Solutions, a licensed clinical marriage and family therapist and a certified sex therapist. Natasha has been in practice for over 20 years and specializes in mental health therapy, sex therapy, and sexuality concerns, family couples, services, and faith transitions within spiritual journeys. So apparently Lisa Butterworth is not feeling well, so she will not be in here. Jennifer White is a licensed clinical social worker who specializes in helping people with depression, anxiety, sexuality concerns, trauma, and faith transitions / journeys. Jennifer works for Symmetry Solutions and has taught sexual education courses at Utah Valley University. Sari Hughes Zabawa is a licensed clinical social worker, certified Daring Way facilitator, and wellness coach working with Symmetry Solutions to offer in-person and online therapy and wellness coaching. Sarah often works with individuals, couples, and families who are impacted by a shift in their spiritual beliefs and who are seeking support in entering this new awakening with better balance, healthier boundaries, and improved trust in themselves moving forward in a meaningful way. Jenny Eldridge is a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in couples counseling, faith transitions, mixed faith relationships, life transitions, and parenting issues. She offers both therapy and coaching services in office and online for couples, adults, older children, and teenagers at Symmetry Solutions. So I'll now give the floor to our presenters, and I'm going to stop sharing so that Natasha can figure out, let's see how to do this.
All right, welcome to the Sexual What If Syndrome, Grieving Our Sexual Development. We are sorry that Lisa can't join us today, but we're excited to have Sarah and Jenny and Jennifer, all of whom are work for Symmetry Solutions with me and are also all in the process of training towards their own sex therapy certification. So I'm really excited to have them all join me today. And we thought we would start with, when we're thinking about how to get through something, people like kind of ideas of what's the path forward, right? So just a quick idea of how we've formatted this this discussion is we're going to start with kind of validating of the problem, why we might be feeling these ways. And then we're going to maybe move into some reframes. How do we look at the problem possibly in different ways so that we can have a more positive approach or a hopeful approach moving forward, since there's not a lot we can do to change the past. And then we're going to move towards specific suggestions and strategies at the end. So that's kind of how we've thought through this presentation. So we're going to start with, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and consider the idea that we would have had a story where sex positive sexual development was something that was honored and prioritized and thought of and intentional from, you know, the many different places where we get our sexual education, parents and church and culture and even government, school systems, etc. These are a lot of the things that would have been included. You know, we would have had basically an allowance for acceptance of our bodies and its functions. You know, bodies would have been treated fairly kind of like non-threatening entities. And that means all of our bodies. So that instead of, you know, head, shoulders, knees, and toes, maybe we could have not skipped that whole middle area. We could have been like head, shoulders, penis, vagina, vulva, knees and toes, you know, and it wouldn't have been a big deal. Like talking about those body parts could have been as simple as talking about our elbows and our toes and things like that. So that would have been nice. If we would have had a background where it would have allowed for acceptance of self body exploration, which is something that we're doing really from the womb. So when we self-touch or masturbate or have a relationship with our own body, that wouldn't have been shamed. And, you know, it's been about 50 years now that the American Pediatric Association has come out with their position that masturbation is normative childhood development behavior. So it'd be nice if that would have been how we were treated. It would have been nice if sexual function as a whole would have been normalized and relational exploration, so that we don't have this divide between, you know, being kind of treated as asexual beings when you're not partnered in a marriage to turn the light on and now we're going to be super sexual once, you know, this one ceremony on this one day happens. So all along the life cycle, sexual function, how sex works, how bodies work would have been, you know, normalized. And also we would have had bridges towards that end goal where, you know, you can have some relational exploration through crushes and teenage land types of spaces. It would have been nice if our gender identity and gender roles would have been treated as normal in the sense of having some fluidity, that we don't necessarily all fall into traditional masculine and feminine roles, that we don't all necessarily fall along the binary of gender expression as we typically tend to think about in our current culture. It would have been nice if it would have been normalized to have a fluid presentation of sexual orientation and the people show up all over the spectrum in regards to being attracted to the opposite sex, to the same sex, to both, to neither, to all of, you know, everything in between. It would have been nice if sexual fantasy and eroticism would have been seen as normalized, that we are very imaginative and curious creatures, and that a lot of that has to do with our eroticism and things that turn us on, things that we think about maybe when we're 7 years old and masturbating, and then 15 years old and masturbating, and then 18 years old and maybe kissing somebody, and et cetera, instead of being seen as something negative. It would have been nice if we would have been offered comprehensive sexual education, you know, in our school systems and in our, and even in other systems, so that it wouldn't have been just so reproductive focused or even fear and danger focused, that it could have been pleasure focused and it could have included all the parts of our erotic selves instead of just the reproductive parts, which is, by the way, one of the reasons the clitoris is not mentioned in current public school education, because it has no reproductive use. Isn't that lovely? So then it would have been nice if we would have had a lot of emphasis on, instead of, you know, protecting yourself from an STI with a condom, which is important, but also to have a lot of emphasis on consent and sexual boundaries and communication, not how do body parts come together, but how to communicate, how does the verbal aspect and the visual aspect and the communication aspect happen during, you know, our sexual educations. And it would have been really nice if sexual expectations by the overall culture would not have tied our own sexual development, our own sexual explorations, our own sexual thoughts, our own sexual experiences to anything having to do with our integral worth as a person, that it would have had nothing to do with whether or not a divine being was disappointed or pleased in us, and that it would have had nothing to do with eternal consequences. In other words, a very fear-driven approach. So this would have been nice if these things would have been offered to us.
Some of the most common things are like the what ifs, right? As individuals are having a faith awakening or transitioning and kind of claiming their own sexual health and wellness as separate from a church institution, it's really normal to have the shoulda, woulda, couldas and the what ifs. One that's very common in the work that we do with clients is complex feelings of either shame or guilt regarding masturbation, including interviews regarding masturbation. And while some individuals have positive, healthy experiences with ecclesiastical leaders talking about sexual health and wellness, a large portion do not. And one of the ones we most often see in our practice is being shamed for masturbation. And not having the permission to self-explore. And like Natasha said, the American Psychological Association has come forward, as well as the American Pediatric Association, regarding how masturbation is a developmentally normal feature. We actually have images of children self-stimulating in utero. There can be shame and guilt for premarital sex or exploration because we come from an abstinence-based culture and there isn't permission for the very natural, often organic occurring sexual exploration in early relationships and later relationships. There's this intense feelings of shame and guilt. And as adults come forward and they're unpacking their sexual histories, it's really common to realize, I really wish that was normalized. I wish I didn't feel the level of shame and guilt. And I want to name the difference between shame and guilt really quickly. Shame is the feeling that I am bad, which is very detrimental to our development. Guilt is I have done something bad. Oftentimes, sexual choices within Mormonism has the connotation that you are bad, even though I recognize the church is trying to change and move to more of the guilt behavioral model. It's very common to have regrets of negative impacts of worthiness interviews, both regarding pornography usage, sexual exploration. Even we have clients that come forward with real challenges of having bishop interviews regarding their sexual relationships within their marriage, right? So unpacking that is really a healthy and normal part of the process that we often do as clinicians. Having missed out on sexual opportunities, we had a beautiful question yesterday in our mixed faith marriage panel about now that I'm understanding my sexual health and wellness, I was married as a virgin. I'm really kind of grieving that I didn't have more sexual exploration earlier or possibly with other partners. We're typically within Mormon culture because we don't do sexual health or wellness or language regarding sex well. We can feel ill-equipped for our sexual relationships. So for many people, they have multiple different types of sexual experiences. They come together with their marital partner and they have no education, language, or skills to know how to embark on this new sexual journey with health, communication, consent, or pleasure. Like Natasha said, feeling long-term ramifications of sex-negative education. So even when someone is in a sexual relationship that they feel they have the spiritual permission to explore, having long-term messages of, I shouldn't enjoy this, I don't know how to enjoy this, and feeling low libido, low erotic templates, not even knowing how to safely explore eroticism or what deeply arouses another person because of the sexual shame and the purity culture in which Mormonism surrounds itself with. Another common issue that I think we really need to name and is near and dear to my heart in the work that I do with clients is mixed orientation marriages. We often think of that as an individual who identifies as gay or lesbian married to someone who is straight. But because there has been a lack of sexual education and sexual exploration, it is not uncommon for our Mormon brothers and sisters and family to recognize their sexual orientation and or gender identity is different than they had imagined when they first entered their relationship. So often I work with women who are understanding that they identify now as bisexual, that their sexual orientation is more fluid than they originally thought prior to going into their marital relationship. And that can bring up deep feelings of grief, conflict, and also some real tender questions around identity exploration. Often questions and doubts about possible non-consensual experiences. We can go back in our sexual history and ask ourselves, was that wanted? Was that consensual? With additional education, more questions can come forward. And it can be really important to have a safe space to explore those questions and our sexual questions regarding our sexual health. And it is not uncommon for there to be anger over the influence of polygamy implications within the LDS culture, as many couples are recognizing that polygamy is still a part of our lexicon and is still a part of our doctrinal practices, especially within the temple. Having candid conversations about fears of polygamy, either in your young adulthood or in your current life, and how that has impacted your sexual life history is really important. As a panel, we were talking the other day about this, and I remember as a young person, probably 16 and 17, and being deeply concerned that I would be a polygamous wife in the eternities and what that would mean for me. Right? So this is not uncommon, and it's something that we don't have often the language to name or safely name within our Mormon experience. So, yes, you were possibly harmed and affected by negative sexual messages. And so this is where we're going to reframe and do a therapeutic principle of where we show you it is not just one or the other, it is both.
So one of the reframes that we would like to offer you is that this is not a unique problem to Mormonism. So we don't say that to minimize the impact of the messaging that you might have received from Mormonism that wasn't very helpful, but just to let you know.
Jenny, we're having a hard time hearing you. I don't know if you can get closer to your microphone or something.
Oh, sure. Try this again. Is that better?
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Keep talking.
Let me bump up my audio. Is that better?
Yeah, a little bit better. Yeah.
All right. Sorry about that. So one of the reframes that we would like to offer you is this is not unique to Mormonism. And so we don't say that to minimize the impact that Mormonism messaging may have had on you, but to offer you the idea that this is a common human problem throughout the whole globe. It's, you know, when we're adults, we tend to want to think about what our childhood was like and maybe romanticize or idealize. What would it have been like if I wasn't raised in this particular situation? If it wasn't like this, then maybe this wouldn't happen. If it wasn't like that, maybe this wouldn't have happened. But the reality is that many cultures, many families, many governments, and many religions all have a lot of sexual negative baggage to sift through. It just seems to be part of the millennial human story. And you can check that with yourself by maybe talking to a close friend or maybe a close family member, even just listening to different podcasts where they're talking about their own exposure to sexual experiences and education, you'll find that there tends to be a lot of awkwardness around all of that. It just seemed to be sort of this human story that we have. And finally, as professionals, we just want to offer to you that we see people of all kinds of backgrounds come into our offices with all kinds of sexual difficulties as well.
Forgot to unmute myself. All right. It's really important for us to have realistic expectations about these things. Jenny briefly said some things about this. So these are some good questions for us to consider. Would we have had access to the experiences the way that we think that we would? Now, this is picture on here on this slide is actually John Oliver, And in, it was 2015, he did a great episode on sex education and actually has some very good information. And in there, he said something kind of funny as a way to kind of laugh at himself. He's like, abstinence is a healthy choice that many will make either by choice or, as I can attest, by circumstance. So yeah, like we may not have had all, you know, we certainly probably didn't have the knowledge or the education to have these great experiences in the past. And yeah, at least as me as a teenager, I had acne. Also, would the experiences we missed out on necessarily been positive? Again, we can glamorize that. Maybe, and maybe not. You know, yeah, not for sure. And do we make room for the developmental stages that we were at? You know, as a teenager, we wouldn't show up as our 40-year-old self with all our knowledge and experience to those same experiences. Also think about like the sex education that we receive. It's not the best in America. Only 22 states mandate that we have sex education, and only 13 states require that the information be medically accurate. Okay. Very concerned about that. Yeah, and so that's going to have an effect for all on us. And also, was our overall environment sex positive? This is something I like to definitely explore a lot in therapy and kind of look at the positive and negative messages we are giving and finding reframes for those the negative messages.
So this whole grass is greener is a very common way that we think about the past. It's interesting that, you know, one of the traits of human nature is to retell our stories, to go back and retell our stories and to, you know, with hindsight, you know, there's a lot of things that you would think about now that you wouldn't have thought in the past. But yeah, it's not always, the grass isn't always greener, right? It's kind of the way that saying goes, and that's, there's some wisdom in that. Because we don't have, you know, all of these things are happening within the context of our imagination and our creativity, but not in the context of reality. And most situations, you know, have issues too that we don't necessarily perceive. And it's a common tendency to think about the good stuff versus the possible bad stuff. So kind of like, you know, Jen was saying in the last slide, sexual experiences can go either way. This idea that somehow if I hadn't been Mormon, if I hadn't been taught sex negativity, I would have had all of these wonderful experiences. I would have just, you know, had the time of my life and, you know, maybe, but, you know, I talk to a lot of non-Mormon clients who have a lot of negative kind of baggage about their college years where maybe they had, you know, 5 to 10 different partners and whether or not they felt that those relationships were things that they felt pressured into or that they really enjoyed and didn't really know how to advocate for themselves and their sexual pleasure. And it's a mess too, right? So everything's messy, I guess is what I want to say. Like things are not just usually good or bad. Things are usually, you know, have a little bit of both. People who have more partners and experiences still present with sexual problems. I mean, sex therapists obviously don't just exist in religious cultures. You know, there's sex therapy is a very growing profession right now, and we're seeing people from all walks of life, all different backgrounds, all different kinds of sexual experiences, both, you know, similar to us, where maybe there wasn't a lot of sexual exploration, and people who have had significant sexual exploration and still come in with lots of issues. The other thing that I'll say is a common one that I hear a lot of times is, if we would have been able to have sex with each other before we got married, we would have figured out whether or not we were sexually compatible. And in some cases that can be true. There are, you know, sexual compatibilities that are so starkly different that maybe that would have been a helpful thing to be thinking about. And most of us in young women, you know, when we were coming up with our lists of what we wanted in our sexual partner, we weren't taught to include, you know, sexual attraction is something that you might put on the list right under, you know, priesthood holder. So sometimes we didn't prioritize sexual chemistry and sexual feelings. And I've heard a lot of people talk to me too about, I actually avoided partnering with the person I had a lot of sexual chemistry with because I didn't want to sin with them. So instead I married my best friend, you know, the person that maybe I had less erotic energy with. So that can be problematic. At the same time, I want to say that sexual attraction and sexual relationships, especially in long-time monogamous relationships, tends to be fluid as well. There are plenty of people that had super hot sex before they were married or right in their honeymoon periods, and 10 years into the, you know, into the relationship, they're really struggling to recapture that erotic energy between them. So again, I don't want you to just assume that if we had done this, we wouldn't be having the current problems that we're having. Maybe, maybe not. And I think it's also important to notice the good stuff. Maybe not everything that we grew up with was negative. Maybe there were protective factors in some of the principles we grew up with. I know I've talked to a lot of people who feel like the law of chastity was a protective kind of barrier that helped them, you know, not worry about unwanted pregnancy, not worry about STIs, that felt very good about being able to explore their sexuality with one partner that they felt this lifetime commitment towards. So a lot of people really enjoy those ideas and feel like that benefited them. And there's a lot of sex positive things that you can find in Mormon culture and Mormon doctrine. And in fact, we've done a podcast on Mormon sex positive approaches. So those are things that you can look up. But I know that Jennifer Finlayson Fife, who did a dissertation on Mormon women, it was, she did a study, it was oral. So it was like, you know, kind of just an interview type study. And it was a small sample. I think it was about 25 people, but what was really interesting and what she found out is that for those for which the law of chastity was something positive, these women would report that they felt empowered, that they felt like the law of chastity was something that gave them access to decision-making. I don't have to give in to peer pressure. I don't have to do something I don't want to do. I can make those decisions for myself in a timeline that I'm comfortable with. So again, let's give credit where credit is due to our upbringings as well. So given all of this, you know, like I said, we're validating the problem. We offered you some reframes. What can you do about it? So we're going to move into some of our possible solutions, which of course, none of this is comprehensive, right? But one of the things that we can do, which is kind of what Jenny was talking about in her slide, is normalize, right? So we are not the only people that deal with these kinds of issues. Give yourself some grace. It's normal to have these feelings and frustrations. It's normal to have the what if and the grass is greener type of narratives. Notice them. Allow for the grief cycle concepts, you know, like the anger and the sadness and, you know, moving towards that kind of sense of acceptance of where we come from and where we want to go from here. Hopefully you can use those feelings as information. What are they informing you about? What are you angry and sad about? Because when you really dig deep into those questions, it gives you information as to, okay, given what I can control now, what types of energies and what types of movement and direction do I want to go into? So put your story into perspective in regards to the larger human story. The larger human story actually is quite drastically tragic when it comes to sexuality. It still is in many parts of the world where people are literally killed and due to honor issues, even with sexual assault issues in many countries, it can be seen as a reason to have lost your honor, even if it wasn't your choice. I mean, we have some pretty horrific history in regards to controlling people's sexuality, which has been done through religion and government and family. And it's just been a really tragic story. So if anybody's ever interested in in studying sexual history, it's not that great. You know, it's pretty dire. So we do want to celebrate also the many ways that we have advanced as a society, the many freedoms that we in our particular situation do enjoy, and the fact that you have a lot of freedom going forward in things that you may want to consider differently.
Another solution that we would like to offer you is to give yourself permission for a few different things. One of them is education. So if you notice that you are feeling like, you know, I feel like I'm not quite fully educated on everything I should be. Some things I'm hearing with my friends or with family members, I feel like I'm not quite well-versed there. We would love to give you some educational opportunities. I'm going to point you to natashaparker.org, where you can look at several of her, she has recommendations and resources that you can look into. So we would love for you to look into podcasts, workshops, any retreats or seminars that are available in your area or online. Secondly, we would love for you to give you permission to unpack your sexual shame. And what we mean by that, Sarah touched on shame earlier, and just to kind of remind you again that shame means that I feel bad, not necessarily I feel bad, but I am bad. I'm a bad person. And a lot of us carry sexual shame that we may or may not be super aware of. And you can tell if you have some, that if, like, let's say we're going through this webinar together and you're noticing that you have some anxiety or fear, or maybe even judgment, or maybe even anger around some of the things that are being shared with you, that's going to give you an indication that you have something there that you need to unpack. A lot of us have sexual shame around our bodies and our genitalia. Sometimes we're not very comfortable with our bodies or genitalia. We may wish that they were a different shape or a different size. Some of us have sexual shame around maybe sexual acts or positions, like kind of like this is bad, this is good. We can't do that, we should do this. And so you might want to look into that too, and you can do that through your education. And we would really love to give you permission to allow or explore what your relationship with your own pleasure and eroticism is. And some of us do carry some sexual shame in that area about, and that tends to be correlated with the morality that we grew up with. Kind of, again, that binary, this is good, this is bad, yay versus nay. I can't have this. Or if I deny myself pleasure, that means I'm being more spiritual. And so we would love for you to continue to explore that relationship. And just one more thing, we might have sexual shame around some fantasies or turn on things that we get turned on. And I just want to point out that we know through research that a lot of people have fantasies about things that they don't really want to happen in real life. And so people tend to carry some shame around that, and we would love for you to unpack that as well too. And so some of these things you may be able to do on your own, and you know, through your own education, and some of these things you might need professional help with too. Particularly those who've also had some sexual trauma, you might need someone in the professional realm to help you unpack that as well too.
All right, understanding your sexual values. This is such an important concept. Definitely as a way to improve your sexual lives. And it also gives a lot of education. And we start, like, I normally start with these basic principles. These are actually, we get these from Doug Braun Harvey. And he's done a lot of research as well as looked at a lot of the definitions of sexual health that come from the World Health Organization. That's part of how I came up with these. So these are consent. And so, and we think that's clear, you know, but it isn't always. Consent is, most sexual education doesn't say anything about consent. So that's definitely a concern of mine. So with that, think about, is there a clear yes? You know, are they saying yes? Is there a clear yes from their body language? and verbally? Is it safe for them to say no? Can you choose whether or not to engage in a sex activity? Can you stop the activity at any time during your sexual contact? Very important things to be safe in a relationship. Non-exploitive, and this actually covers a lot. For what, if any, are there power imbalances? And there's probably to one degree going to be a little bit of that. Is information being withheld from one partner? Is guilt being used? Pressuring the other person in any way to have sex? So there's a lot to explore with that. The next one's protection from HIV, STIs, and unwanted pregnancy. So having the safe talk beforehand, the safe sex talk definitely is important, and an ongoing one. Honesty. So how transparent are you with your partner? Are you sharing your wants and desires with your partner? Are you keeping your agreements? There is sometimes some tension with safety and desire. And so part of these is kind of figuring out a way to balance that. Honesty is certainly important. But that doesn't mean we have to say that you look ugly. Like, you know what I mean? The way that we're showing up and being honest, we can do that in kind ways. Having shared values. And part of that really is like, this is sometimes called the other sex talk. What does having sex mean to you? What do you want that to include? There's so much there to explore. And then mutual pleasure, certainly very important. Making sure that these experiences for both partners, that they are having pleasure. And there's a lot of education, as has already been mentioned, that we don't, most of us don't get. Definitely, I think it's important to have education about the clitoris. Yeah. So there's so much here just with those six. Natasha has actually done a podcast on each one of these topics that are over an hour. So this could take a lot of time, but I'm not going to take that right now. Now, you guys, you know, we're each the authority of our own life, and we get to kind of add to this. What are the values that are important to you? What's important to you with your sexual health and satisfaction and well-being, and taking time to explore that and make your list. This is often a therapy assignment. I think all of us give, and really thinking, you know, what are your values and are those informing your decisions? So take time to reflect on that. And this really helps you kind of, I think, show up as your genuine self. And I'm going to add, give yourself to show up imperfectly. And we can always grow and change, but we have permission to be imperfect.
Another thought is to reconstruct where needed. So you know, going along with what Jen just talked about values, a lot of times we grew up with the idea that values are to-do lists or to not to-do lists, right? So this is okay, this is not okay. As I started my Mormon therapist blog over a decade ago now, the questions I would get were oftentimes, is it okay to have oral sex? You know, is it okay to watch pornography with my spouse if they're okay with it? You know, is it okay? And so we come from this culture where we have conflated, I think, values with behaviors. So I think going back to the drawing table and really understanding what is okay with us, right? Not that some outer authority is necessarily giving us this information, but what are we going to be okay with? And so in regards to dealing with sexual what ifs, you know, if you are sad, for example, that you never got to have a one-night stand. Well, a one-night stand may not even fit into your values. It may not, who knows? But one of the things that I really like about Modern Family, the show Modern Family, is that the couple that is heterosexual and has all the kids, I forget their names, but they have this like yearly tradition where they go out and they pretend they don't know each other and they pick each other up, you know, at the bar, and they have this kind of flirtatious playfulness, and they rent a hotel and they go have, you know, hookup sex with their spouse, you know? And so they have this very playful, creative way to include something that maybe they have a fantasy about, but they don't have really any interest, or it doesn't fit with their values to do in real life, but they're still engaging in the eroticism of that idea. So you can do that through solo sex. You know, if your partner isn't interested in maybe the same things that you are excited about, you can, you know, hopefully in your partnership have an idea that you have a right to some sexuality that's just personal and individual and your own, which is something that usually we didn't grow up with that idea. So through solo sex or masturbation or your own erotic imagery or relationship with erotic materials, you can play in fantasy world and some of those things. Obviously you can in partnered sex do some things that are fun and decide to do differently. Like now we are going to have a relationship with oral sex, whereas maybe before we didn't. You can have fantasy sex, kind of like what I just described. And, you know, some people do actually explore consensual non-monogamy options to explore certain things that maybe they want to explore outside of the two bodies that are within a monogamous marriage. It's not as common, but, you know, there are ways to do that. And I am actually doing a presentation tomorrow on consensual non-monogamy and how to avoid pitfalls and grief in that regard. Taking a personal ownership and shared sexuality approach, I think, is really important. Like I was mentioning, most of us were given the idea that, you know, you belong to me, I belong to you, all these romantic notions that, you know, you're my soulmate, you're my one and only. They can sound really romantic, but when you really look down in the, and, you know, kind of unpack them, they're pretty possessive. They're pretty much about, you know, if I'm not comfortable with something, you don't have the right to. And so that's a very interesting tension that's very common in negotiating sexual contracts within a partnership, because there's me, you know, what I'm interested in, what my comfort levels are, what my erotic template is, what my orientation is, et cetera. And then there's all of that for you as well. And where do we find the spaces where we come together well, and what do we do with the spaces where we don't? And so that's pretty much what a lot of sex therapy is about, is helping couples negotiate those divides. So hopefully you can, you know, make those decisions from this perspective that I don't own you sexually. I am my own sexual agent, but I do want to share myself sexually with you. How do we do that in a way that's healthy and honors both of our comfort levels at some level, you know, at some point? I always say good negotiations means that each of you are uncomfortable with something, right? So, and then make decisions about your sexual success from a self-partner authority space. We have so many outer authorities that try to tell us what successful sex is going to look like, whether it's the media. The media has a lot of ideas, right, about how successful sex is going to look like. Like, you're both going to orgasm at the same time, and you're both going to be fit and young and white and have zero body hair, right? Well, most of us don't fit any of those, you know, parameters. And so how are you going to decide what successful sex and sexual experience and sexual expression is going to look like given your situation?
Hey, Natasha, let me just jump in here. I know you said you wanted about 15 minutes left for questions, and we're right at 15. So I know I'll let you decide what you want to do here.
Thank you. We're just about finished.
Okay.
Wonderful. So let's be part of the solution. One of the things is, while we're wrestling with a potential sexual shame or our sexual lives, we can also be the difference moving forward. So consider being a sex positive parent or family member. I think oftentimes we think about our own sexual lives, but we all have individuals we can influence and support, if that's nieces, nephews, brothers, sisters, children. And if you don't know how to be a sex positive family member, reach out. Let's get you some resources. Education is helpful for all of us. Also, there's something so incredibly powerful about repair work. I call it the circle back. All of us have made mistakes. I'm a young parent. I have parents. We've all made mistakes. And if we can simply circle back and say, hey, I didn't know that. I realize this now. I'm really sorry. Is there anything specifically I could apologize for or do better moving forward? As I can tell you how many sessions that I've done with our LGBTQ loved ones and their parents with allowing them to do some circle back work. I mean, we didn't even talk about how hard it is to parent sex positive parents, let alone sex positive children that we don't even understand their gender identity with, right? There's so much permission we can do in repair work. If comfortable in the role, be an advocate in your community and where you can be an influence. Raise your hand. Say, you know, think about your sphere of influence. When we think of advocacy, we think about, you know, big marches or storming the school board. Think about where your sphere of influence is. It might be at your dinner table. It might be at your family reunion. You can make a difference exactly where you are and in alignment with your values. Also, this is a social worker in me, make sex positive informed decisions regarding your voting and supporting certain policies and movement. We will not become a sex positive country or a sex positive community or Mormon culture without our advocacy and using our rights and our privilege in voting, both at the local and national level.
So thank you so much for attending this. We hope we've hit on some useful ideas and thoughts. And then I would like to open up the rest of the time for questions.
All right. So first question that we've got here says, what if I had less guilt as a teen for just about every remotely sexual thought? Even in most of my 20-year marriage, I have only had a few years guilt-free, and I am 43 years old. Oh, how would my life be different?
Yeah, so I think question is basically a contemplative question, which kind of goes right into the what-if syndrome, right? Is how would my life have looked different? And I usually encourage people to, you know, when you think about these things, not that you have to think about it from the timeline that I'm going to share right now, but it's kind of like, give yourself, you know, like 10 minutes or 15 minutes or half an hour or 3 days or whatever it is to really think through those things. What's the sadness there? What do you imagine could have been different? What comes to mind as you contemplate that? How do you visualize aspects of yourself having been different? Be mad about it. Be sad about it, right? Like lean hard into those feelings. Hit a pillow or two, right? Go on a run. You know, like really let yourself go there. And then kind of like mindfully put a pause, almost like a timer going off, or, you know, take a shower, or do something ritualistic that says, you know, for this moment, I'm going to let that be. And now I'm going to look at where do I go from here so that you don't get stuck or paralyzed by those thoughts, and then maybe take some of our suggestions from today. And you may have to do that over and over again. I'm not saying you do that just once, you know, like, oh, there's this 10-minute period and then it's over forever. You may have to do that on a weekly basis for a while or a monthly basis, but do that mindfully so that you don't just get stuck in this ongoing repetitive what if cycle that psychologically can be quite harmful. So we want to use that to inform us and to get over it, but not to get stuck.
Okay, next question. How do I deal with my anger at the church as a gay man that didn't get around to accepting myself and understanding that the church's description of me was incorrect until I was almost 60 years old? I feel that I was robbed of a life partner and possible family until later in life because of my distorted view of my sexuality and worth.
Sarah, do you want to take this one?
I'd love to. Rick, can you will you reread the very first part of the question? I think it said, how do I get over is it the anger? I just want to be
anger,
really clear.
Yes. How to deal with my anger at the church as a gay man.
I want to first validate that your anger is real it is valid, and I'm a believer that anger brings forward wisdom. So if there could be a moment of reflection and ask, where is my anger coming from? Because typically anger is an example of boundary violations. And the person who asked this question just listed the examples of how not giving the permission and freedom and support to explore their sexual orientation and marry a man and build a family, that's a boundary violation at the soul core level. So your anger makes a lot of sense. If we're wanting to move past anger because the anger and the boundaries related to the church are not allowing you to be well, this is where we move into grief work. It's really looking at how do we give the church less power in our lives now and in our sexual choices now. So I guess my answer, there's no simple answer, but it's a process. It's about naming your grief. It's about naming your anger and probably working with someone to really think about what now. How do I need to write a letter to the church? Do I need to make a public statement? Is there something symbolic to name and create a boundary with that anger? And at the same time, with anger being a normal part of grieving, how do we move through that, accept it, and also have moments of more hope, of reconciliation, if that's possible, looking to what do we want to do with your sexual orientation and your sexual identity now?
Really quickly, I would add that in the cases of sexual orientation wounds, sexual trauma wounds, those types of wounds are at a level that we would say you deserve help with that. You know, if you can have access and resources to a therapist, a professional mental health person who can help you work through that, because those things are so difficult that it's hard to work through on your own.
In addition, Natasha, building community of likewise individuals who survived that specific type of sexual trauma. I'm immediately thinking of our affirmation LGBTQIA+ family and friends community. Sometimes having a collective space to know you're not alone in both your anger and your grief can be a really important part of the community healing process.
Perfect.
I just want to also add a layer of clarification that having anger isn't necessarily a bad thing to have. Sometimes it, as Sarah mentioned, it informs us of boundary crossing. It informs us of actions that we want to take. It's not necessarily something that we have to stop and get rid of. It can be part of the process that can be quite a positive movement moving forward.
Okay, next question. I was abused for years in my marriage, and now I have an LGBT+ child. I have discovered much I didn't know. How do we prevent a new generation from not realizing that, for example, a hypersexual man and a demisexual woman will not probably have a great life together?
Jen, do you want to talk about this at all from the perspective of values or violence or any along those lines, or not to put you on the spot.
Can you just repeat the question?
Okay. I was abused for years in my marriage, and now I have an LGBT+ child. How do we prevent a new generation from not realizing that a hypersexual man and a demisexual woman will not probably have a great life together?
Okay. Well, there's a lot there. There's a lot. That's pretty complex.
There's four different ways we could go in that question alone.
I don't know how to give a simple answer. I do want to just validate that, like, gosh, a lot of feelings there. And yeah, for any relationship to be successful, looking at the sexual values is a good way to start. And what are your sexual values? And exploring that and being able to choose for yourself, not what maybe other people are telling what's going to be right for you, but kind of owning your own decision and exploring that in a healthy way. Definitely, I'm very passionate about LGBTQ plus issues where, that just validating that there's nothing wrong with who you are. And that's part of you, and you don't have to enter into a straight marriage or anything like that. You can pick what's healthy for you.
I think too, so much of what the question is also, it just points to a generational gap. You know, when I was growing up, demisexual, like what the heck is that? You know, whereas the newer generations have done a great job of really adding, you know, why do we say LGBTQIA plus, you know, it's like, there's all these words and all these new ways that people are learning. I have a right to label myself in a variety of ways. It doesn't have to be homosexual, heterosexual anymore, you know? And so I think that at the base of the question, it's about education. How do we offer or are open to educational information that the younger generation is much more savvy about? We maybe didn't get that. You know, if you're older than 35, you're having a different experience than those who maybe are in their mid-20s right now, or even those who are teens. Being open to your kid and sharing, like, you know, these are some of the things that we weren't taught were important to prioritize. You know, like, should we, you know, we probably should prioritize the mating process at a higher level than just whether or not we're both active members of the same church, right? Like, we probably should consider other ways whether or not we're compatible. I think a very harmful message that we've gotten at church sometimes is that as long as you're both, you know, aligned with God, any two people can make it. Not so much, you know, like there's a lot of things that go into successful partnerships, from personality traits, conflict resolution, sexual chemistry, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think you're already on the right path by asking this question. How can I basically tell my kid, you probably need to look at, you know, a lot of parts of what's going into a long-term partnered decision. Sarah, did I cut you up?
I just wanted to name that the person asking this question already looks like they have done really good education in even naming the different compatibilities in their sexual partnership, as well as recognizing, let's do the circle back. Let's go to your kid and say, hey, mom and dad were really incompatible and we did not have the sex education that we would really like you to have, especially as an LGBTQ individual. How can we support you in getting the resources we didn't have?
Okay. Next question. Do you have suggestions for how to navigate conversations about what ifs with your spouse in a healthy way?
Jenny.
Too many Jennies in the room. I know. Yeah, that's a great question, because that's kind of going back to negotiating with your spouse. So when you're negotiating with your spouse, you kind of want to bring up the feeling. Hey, this is just something I'm feeling and wondering about. It might be a little bit uncomfortable for you. What do you think about this? And as we mentioned in our seminar last night, we want to kind of use a measurement scale of how comfortable you are with making new changes when you're negotiating with your partner. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being really uncomfortable, like, oh my gosh, I might have a panic attack if we kind of go down this realm, to 1 being, I'm pretty chill about that. Anything that's like kind of like a 3, 4, 5, you're slightly uncomfortable with it, we might encourage you to maybe try it out, experiment with it. You might be uncomfortable at first, but it might be one of those things that you get comfortable with over time. A lot of partnerships are like that. A lot of life is like that. It's just constant negotiation, especially when someone that you're in a relationship with. There's always going to be this degree of uncomfortableness, so we just kind of want to normalize that. You're reintroducing a lot of new things, and naturally you're going to be uncomfortable, and some things you might turn out to be a pleasant surprise. You never know.
I didn't like pickles once, but now I do. And I would add to it the sandwich approach, right? So a lot of times when you're bringing up what ifs for the partner, it can feel like a threat. Like, does that mean I'm not enough for you? Does that mean that you regret being with me? Does that mean that, you know, you wish you hadn't married me, right? So it can feel like a threatening conversation. So how you start the conversation is really important. And so sandwich approach is like start with positive and end with positive and put the meat or the difficult part in between. So you start with like, you know, I love you, right? You know that like I'm so, you know, excited about our marriage. I don't regret whatever those things are that you can say that there's, you know, I love our sex life. I love so many things about us. And don't use the but word. And I've been thinking, right? Or I've been struggling with, you know, kind of seeing, especially through this faith transition or whatever, about things that, you know, maybe I missed out on or how I thought about things. And I'd like to be able to have a conversation with you about how we could at least have some chats about what this is like and whether or not that means that there's anything we should change. And back to the, you know, the bread. You know, I really want to do this because I want to be closer to you, because I want us to thrive, because I want to be honest about what I'm thinking about. I want us to be more intimate, have more positive experiences. So you want to assuage the potential fear that your partner might be having as part of these conversations.
All right. Well, I know we're about a minute over. I'm going to finish with one last question, and then I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of them. The last question: in the former Mormon community, there is some discussion about the Mormon community is a good place to raise kids. Mormon views on sexuality seem like it is basically a very unhealthy environment that starts damaging people from a young age. Based on sexuality education, isn't the Mormon culture a very damaging environment? Does it have any redeeming value?
I'm sure we could all have thoughts on this. I'm just going to say really quickly, there was a sex positive podcast that I did. I think if you Google Natasha Helfer Parker, sex positive Mormonism, you could look at that, because I do think there's two sides to every coin. I do think also that as a parent, you have a lot of influence. So in my family, oftentimes if we came home from church and I had heard something negative, I would say something like, by the way, I don't agree with sister so-and-so on this particular topic, right? So kind of model disagreeing with leaders or people in the church is a good way to teach critical thinking for kids. And then you also want to be able to give them permission to have their own ideas and values and also teach them boundaries. So for example, if you're ever in the bishop's office and you don't feel comfortable answering a question, you know, you can always say, I don't want to answer that question, or I need to go to the bathroom, or I want my mom, right? Or things like that. So teaching boundaries, et cetera. That the reality is that many environments are not necessarily healthy. You could say the same thing about the public school system or going to grandma's house or going to a certain church environment. All environments have a risk to potentially sexually harm our kids. So if you're going to decide to have a relationship with an entity that has some potential issues, how do you help your kids have boundaries, education, and give them permission for critical thinking and not be in trouble with you if they disagree? And there's actually some things that they could really benefit from that in being in an environment where they have a voice. So and then if you feel like you need to leave because of it's unhealthy, that's perfectly fine too. And I know many parents, for example, of gay, transgender kids who make that choice, because in a lot of ways, yes, the Mormon church is currently having standards and ideas around certain aspects of sexuality that I'm very comfortable saying are sex negative and potentially abusive and harmful for many aspects of the society.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. I'll try to sneak in one last thing here before I let you go. It says, how do we find a sex-positive therapist who understands LDS struggles? I think we have four people right here. So do you guys have an email address or anything you'd like to share?
Yes, and we're on the WOVA app, Symmetry Solutions. Check out our page. We also have a giveaway. All of these amazing people are offering 1 hour of their therapy or coaching services as a giveaway. So go sign up for that. We also have the Mormon Mental Health Association that I helped found, where we vetted all of the therapists that are on those directories to be sex positive, faith transition friendly, and LDS culturally competent. So, and then we're Symmetry Solutions, and we can also help you with other resources, even if you don't choose to see us. We're always happy to give you referrals.
All right, thanks everybody. Enjoy your lunch, and we're gonna end this session.
Thank you.